This is funny. This was the impeachment trial of Bill Clinton. My ticket to it. And this is fun. Here, this is Bill Roth had to give a speech, so I put together the cards for him. And then he came back and said, I've got something for you, and he dropped these on my desk. And I was throwing them out. I thought, oh, well, okay, well, who scribbled on this? Before I threw them out, I saw William Westmoreland, the commanding general of Vietnam, Bob Hope, Dolores Hope, Adrian Cronauer, good morning, Vietnam.
Yes.
Colin Powell.
How in the world did he get?
He was just, he had to speak.
Yeah.
And so they were on the dais. And I guess he just thought, for my buddy Bill, I'm going to get all these guys autographs for him.
Meet William Nixon. Early in his career, he worked as a speechwriter for the Reagan administration. He then spent 15 years alongside Senator Bill Roth. Yes, the Roth behind the Roth IRA, co-authoring the book, The Power to Destroy, chronicling the Senate investigation that reshaped the IRS. From there, he built a Washington, D.C.-based international government relations and communications practice, working with businesses, Fortune 500 companies, and industry groups on policy and public narratives. That is the resume. It is impressive. It is also almost beside the point. I meet Bill at his home in Midway. The first thing you notice isn't the rooms, it's the feeling of vertical space. The ceiling rises wide and open with floor-to-ceiling bookshelves that climb two stories, each section of books holding a different world. The classics, history, religion. A warm wood ladder, the kind you'd expect in an old library or a film set, crawls up the wall, sliding easily along the shelves. His grandkids use it like a playground. Up, always reaching up. Around the home, pictures of family sit beside mementos from decades of travel. A chunk of the Berlin Wall rests unassumingly on a desk. Bill moves through it all like someone introducing old friends. I come armed with carefully researched questions about leadership and legacy. My husband tags along. I know he'll find Bill fascinating, and I'm correct. We talk for 5 hours before I ever turn on a microphone. By the end, I haven't even asked one of my original questions. What I find instead is something I hadn't expected. A man who has spent 50 years at the highest levels of American political life and who, at the heart of it all, is simply a writer. He always has been. Bill Nixon grew up the oldest of six children. Born in Washington, D.C., mostly raised in Salt Lake City. He says he knew he wanted to write before he even knew how. Second grade, that's when it landed. He filled his beloved father's legal pads with short stories before he understood the rules behind them. One evening, he climbed up on his dad's bed. He was watching an old TV program, Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea.
I cuddled up with him and said, Dad, I've decided I'm going to be a writer. And he said, you are? And I said, yeah, I'm going to be a writer. And I said, how do you become a writer? And without missing a beat, he said, you go to law school, son.
Spoiler, Bill did not go to law school. He kept writing, eventually earning a degree in English and an MBA. During his junior year of high school, something cracked open.
The first book that really moved me, I'm a little ashamed of it, but I'll be very honest with you, was For Whom the Bell Tolls. And part of, I'd never ever read a book that I dreamt about. The book, I just realized how powerful the written word, I'd never known it to be that incredibly powerful.
From Hemingway, he moved to Steinbeck, then to Churchill, whom he said mobilized the English language and sent it to war. Then in college, he became enamored with the Russian writers.
Hemingway had that. He just stripped it raw down to power dynamics and mortality. But this, when he turned to Tolstoy and he turned to Dostoevsky, they understood it from an eternal perspective. I mean, they really understood that true writing was about the divine, about eternity, about the Grand Inquisitor and the Brothers Karamazov. And that became, that was like electricity to me.
At UNLV, Bill played Division I football and edited the campus newspaper. His junior year, he launched a conservative alternative to Rolling Stone with movies and music reviews.
But, you know, to talk about those in the context of things that still were harmonious with traditional values, and that was really what led to the awareness of me with the Reagan administration.
But before Washington, there was Tammy. Bill's grandfather spotted a young woman in an elevator and was so certain she was the one for his grandson that he stopped the elevator to get her information. She gave him her own grandfather's number, and just like that, the two old men found a new hobby, matchmaking. Bill was not convinced and didn't imagine his next relationship would be brokered in an elevator. But the moment he met Tammy, he knew. 47 years, 3 children, and 7 grandchildren later, he calls her the backbone of everything he ever did. After college, Bill landed at a Las Vegas city magazine. Long-form interviews, a steady paycheck, a mattress on the floor of a loft apartment. He interviewed everyone from Don Rickles to Diana Ross. He was 23 years old. Then the phone rang. Someone from President Reagan's administration called, asking Bill if he wanted to come write for the president. He got home late that night. Tammy was already asleep. He woke her up.
And I said, "I don't know, Tam, I guess our lives come down to this. I can go to Washington, D.C. and write for the most powerful man in the free world, or we can stay in Las Vegas and I can ask celebrities what the most interesting thing in their refrigerator is."
They went to Washington. Bill spent 3 years as a speechwriter in the Reagan administration, a junior chipmunk he calls himself, but he was in the room. He watched Reagan work, drafts returned covered in red ink, the president shaping his own words with intention. Bill was there for the fight between the Oval Office and the State Department over the Brandenburg Gate speech. The State Department argued the line was too provocative. President Reagan said it anyway.
"Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall."
Reagan was Churchillian in his rhetoric. I mean, he really understood the power of rhetoric, and so it was wonderful, you know, being in that environment and learning. And it was really a time of learning again. I was 23, 24 at that point.
As we talk, my eyes drift around Bill's office. It's exactly what you'd expect from someone who has spent a lifetime collecting words and stories. Books line the walls. Collector pens rest like museum artifacts in a cherry wood display case.
So anyway, this is just kind of a walk down Liberace. I interviewed him, Julio Iglesias.
His daughter spent a lot of time gathering photographs, newspaper clippings, and memories into oversized scrapbooks.
There's when Reagan came home from the hospital after he got shot, and Brittany with Tammy, we were welcoming the president back to the...
Bill flips Brittany through them slowly. He stops often, not always to explain, but to remember. Walter Cronkite, Joan Rivers, a football program from an undefeated high school season. Every public moment always gives way to something private. And on the desk where he writes, a mechanical keyboard. It's round keys styled after an old typewriter. Every keystroke answers with a sharp, satisfying click, sounding less like a computer and more like an old newsroom that refuses to go quiet. For all the speeches and campaigns, this is where Bill feels most like himself. But despite everything he's accomplished, there was still the writing he was meant to do. He just hadn't had time. In 2021, everything changed. He and Tammy were in Midway when he felt it. Something was wrong. He told her they needed to get to the local hospital immediately. By the time they were in the car, he says he felt like an elephant was on his chest. At the emergency room, he walked up to the reception window and said he thought he was having a heart attack. A doctor came immediately.
And I knew just by watching them that this was serious. And then Tammy was coming down the hall, and I could hear her say, "My husband is in the," and the doctor says, "Is this your husband just came in?" And she said, "Yes." And And they said, we got to get him to the hospital immediately. And Tammy said, well, what's wrong? And the doctor says, he's having a massive heart attack. I mean, they knew at that point. And Tammy said, well, can I go with him? And they said, no, we got the helicopter's inbound.
Even then, he still had his sense of humor. As they loaded him onto the helicopter, Tammy bent down to kiss him.
And I told her I loved her. And I said, you know the finances. And I said, you're taken care of for the rest of your life. Should I not come back? And you and the kids are going to be just fine. And I said, but just don't let the next guy take advantage of it.
She laughed through the tears. Then the doors closed on the world he knew. And what happened next, he did not expect.
You know, it was an interesting experience. Because my heart attack, I was so filled with feelings of love and gratitude and peace that, and I remember as the helicopter banked out of Provo Canyon and heading left off to the Utah Valley Hospital. It was a beautiful day. There was one cloud in the sky and the rest was just pure blue, cerulean. And I remember thinking, what a beautiful day to die. I mean, I really thought that, and I remember having the thought right after that is, this is the greatest adventure I could ever live.
The doctor later explained the medical explanation of what saved him. Bill had somehow developed a secondary vessel, a frontage road off the freeway that kept the blood moving. I asked Bill what stayed with him at that moment.
The two things that bothered me most, if I was bothered, was that I felt that I hadn't done what I was supposed to do with my writing. And I felt that I was going to miss Tammy.
When he recovered, he made himself a promise. He's represented powerful politicians and global business leaders. One of his clients is the wealthiest man in Asia. He has lived a full life, a consequential life, but still.
I didn't have time for anything but the truth. And I was going to write what was real and what was relevant. The two quotes, the Thomas Wolfe, I was, when youth is gone, every man will look back on that period of his life with infinite sorrow. It's the bitter sorrow and regret of a man who knows that once he had a great talent and wasted it, once he had a great treasure and got nothing from it, it is the sorrow of one who knows that he had strength enough for everything and never used it. That was how I was feeling when it came to writing.
A couple of years later, he was on a small island off the coast of Colombia. He was watching his grandchildren play in the water, listening to a talk by Elder Jeffrey R. Holland. When the idea for his next book arrived all at once, he went home and started writing. Bill is ready to submit it to a publisher. He offers to read my husband and me the opening chapters. We don't hesitate. There's an intimacy to hearing someone read their own work before it is made public. You're not just hearing a story. You're inside the mind that made it.
It's a story about love and redemption. You know, that's deeply philosophic about human relations in the extremities and in the backdrop of modern day characters in a small island with no name off the coast of South America and the historic backdrop of the Cuban Revolution.
Bill gets emotional reading certain passages, and I later ask him why. He says it's the memory of where he was when the story first came to him. 6.5 hours after we sit down together, the conversation turns to where he is now.
So 5 years later, after all this happened with the heart attack and where you are today, and you're finishing off this beautiful, really masterpiece. So tell me how you're feeling.
Oh, well, thank you about calling it a masterpiece.
It really is. It's so beautiful. It's so touching. But tell me what that feels like now, because you had that feeling like, I haven't fulfilled this 5 years ago. And now you've been working on this and you felt guided to do this, it sounds like.
I'll tell you how I honestly feel, and I hope it doesn't sound pretentious. But if I were on the helicopter again tomorrow, that wouldn't be a regret anymore. I would think I've written what I wrote and maybe I was preserved. I'm not saying I was, because I haven't had any clarity on that. I'm not suggesting. But I would not think, you know what, I have a regret.
On his desk sits a pen, a Mont Blanc diplomat, one of 24 he owns. He holds it for a moment before he starts talking.
And so Tammy, for Christmas, gave me this, and I remember it at the time. It was 2000, I don't know, it wasn't even 2000, 1980, probably 1985, 86. It was $280. And I just, I mean, I couldn't believe, but it was really the representative that she loved the fact that I wrote and wanted me to have, you know, the ultimate writing pen. So I carried this for years and years as my wedding band.
A President Reagan speechwriter, a strategist, a Washington hand for 50 years. But strip it all away, and here's what's left.
You know, I do get emotional when I write, because when I'm writing, there's long periods of recognition that I'm not writing. I'm basically just getting words on paper that they're not coming from me. I mean, I'm not claiming revelation, but I'm claiming that it's a process that is probably as close to the divine as any profession can get you, maybe outside of the clergy.
If you sit with Bill Nixon long enough, what you discover is a boy who climbed onto his father's bed one evening and announced he was going to be a writer. He still is, and always will be. This is Amber Borowski-Johnson for KPCW's Community Campfire.